The following recording by the LA Sound Posse contains a talk given by Robert J. Lifton at the University of California at Santa Barbara on February 16th of 2005. The talk was titled, America and the Human Future, Surviving Vietnam, 9/11, and Iraq. The occasion was the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation's fourth annual Frank K. Kelly Lecture, and its presentation of the Award for Lifetime Achievement to Dr. Lifton. David Krieger will give information on the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation at the end of the talk. Introducing Robert J. Lifton is Dr. Richard Falk.
Good evening and welcome to the fourth annual Frank K. Kelly Lecture on Humanity's Future. I'm David Krieger. I'm the president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. We're very, very fortunate to have as our speaker tonight for this lecture series, Robert J. Lifton. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Richard Falk. Richard was a professor at Princeton University in international law and practice for 40 years. He's presently a distinguished visiting professor here at the University of California at Santa Barbara and teaches courses in human rights and in peace and war and other issues that pertain to international law. He's also chair of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. Richard will introduce Robert J. Lifton. So Richard, please.
In my view, no one on the planet better exemplifies the goals of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation than Robert J. Lifton. Ever since his book on Hiroshima survivors, Death and Life, which won the coveted National Book Award in 1969, Dr. Lifton has been carrying on a struggle against the most severe forms of human wrongs that afflict the peoples of the world. He has written notable books on a range of issues that chronicle the extremities of human wrongdoing, including the ordeal of war endured by American GIs in Vietnam, the perverse professionalism of Nazi doctors, the genocidal mentality associated with any contemplated reliance on nuclear weapons, and the historical emergence of what he has insightfully been calling apocalyptic terrorism. In these studies, Dr. Lifton has also forged new methods of research and interpretation that have exerted a very wide influence here and abroad. He has combined the knowledge and approaches of psychiatry with a sophisticated use of social science inquiry, relying on in-depth interviews and on an interpretive approach to his subject matter that is informed by a deep sense of historical and cultural context. The combination of these approaches has given his writing a unique quality of depth and richness that has made it so valuable to many of us over the years as an intellectual resource for understanding the most perplexing and disturbing issues associated with outbreaks of mass violence and collective evil. But Dr. Lifton has done more than achieve an enviable record as a distinguished scholar with a worldwide reputation. He has acted as an exemplary citizen, expressing his views on the most controversial issues of the day, from the atomic attacks on Hiroshima to the ongoing current torment of the American presence in Iraq. His own words, expressed in an interview just prior to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, convey powerfully the wide arc of his personal and political engagement. And I quote, "I feel a mixture of fear, rage, and deep absurdity. This war we are about to embark upon seems to me to be both illegitimate and self-defeating. Harmful not just for the world, but for ourselves." But Dr. Lifton, while being a chronicler of the most extreme evils in our world, is personally engaged in the full spectrum of life experience. Again, in his illuminating words, and I quote, "You look into the abyss, but you don't want to be stuck there. So you want to look beyond it to other human possibilities. And so he has done throughout his life, revealing his worldview in an important scholarly contribution, The Protean Self, that is full of hope and potentiality, a guidebook to a fulfilling and satisfying life carried forward in the face of dispiriting gathering forces. Dr. Lifton played a leading role in the organization Physicians for Social Responsibility that was so active during the 1980s in opposing the nuclear arms race. This organization then became the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and its work was recognized by the receipt of a Nobel Peace Prize in the middle of the 1980s. And so from the perspective of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, Robert Lifton is an ideal recipient of its Lifetime Achievement Award. In giving this award, we are certainly not intending to signal the end of Dr. Lifton's lifetime of achievement. Indeed, as we will shortly witness, we count on him continuing to achieve for a long, long time. I want now to just say a few words to introduce Robert Lifton as the fourth Kelly Lecture. It is wonderful that we have Frank Kelly with us tonight. He is, as David indicated, a prominent and much beloved local presence in the Santa Barbara community, who endowed this lecture series and inaugurated with a lecture of his own in 2001. In some ways, Frank and Robert seem to be contrary personality types. Frank continuously immersed in a virtual ocean of bright-eyed optimism, while Robert seemingly habituates the darkest of human landscapes. But on closer inspection, I think these two citizens of the world are engaged in the same struggle to improve the human condition. Robert Lifton likes to quote the poet Theodore Röthke, one of whose lines was, "In the dark, the eye begins to see," while Frank seems happily comfortable to always be in the light and has no trouble seeing. Robert Lifton was trained as a psychiatrist, attending medical school and studying or having as his mentor the famed and innovative follower of Sigmund Freud, Erik Erikson. He spent time in the Air Force during the Korean War, working as a psychiatrist, and produced an important book on thought control as a technique of warfare and an instrument of rule in totalitarian societies. For, I believe, 25 years, Robert Lifton was a research professor on the medical faculty of Yale University. Since the mid-1960s, Robert, together with his wife, have hosted an annual psychohistory seminar at their summer home in Cape Cod that brought together many of the best minds in America to discuss the most pressing issues of the day. In 1978, he moved to New York City, where he founded and established the Center on Violence and Human Survival, which is part of the City University of New York, and became an important gathering place for all those concerned with the forces endangering the future of the human species and what might be done to bring about desirable change. In 2001, Robert made a further move to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he now lives and is associated with the Harvard Medical School as a lecturer and runs a faculty seminar devoted to mass violence. Robert has been celebrated for his achievements during his long and continuously productive career, winning prizes for his books and receiving a large number of honorary degrees from important universities. It is obvious that I could extend this introduction unbearably if I were to enumerate the high points of Robert Lifton's career. I only want, in closing, to call attention to two of his recent books that bear on the lecture theme of the evening and provide us all with necessary tools for understanding some of what is happening in the world around us. For a precursor of 9/11 and the Al-Qaeda organization, I would commend Robert's truly prophetic study of the Japanese terrorist organization Aum Shinrikyo, with the revealing title, Destroying the World to Save It, published in 1999. The book at once recognized the extremism and absurdity of this cult dedicated to unleashing massive violence in order to purify the world. But Robert Lifton also acknowledges, and I quote, something closer and more dangerous to all of us. The extremist leader of the cult, Shoko Ashihara, quoting Robert Lifton, now seems to me to have been a caricature of present-day leaders of normal countries who deal with ultimate weaponry and must thereby struggle with or surrender to a psychological mix of fear, control, and fantasy that could annihilate us all. In this sense, the message of the book and Robert Lifton's insistent plea is to mobilize the action needed to rid the planet of the dreaded weaponry of mass destruction before it rids the planet of the human species. The other book I would mention is Superpower Syndrome, America's Apocalyptic Confrontation with the World, published in 2003, warning us all that meeting terror with terror is the surest path to self-annihilation, but also informing us that change is possible and that a hopeful future is within our reach if we take advantage of transforming inner and outer potentialities present in our individual and societal circumstances. It is now my great honor to present my longtime and dear friend and this year's Kelly lecturer, Robert J. Lifton.
Thanks very, very much, Richard. I'm deeply moved by that generous, indeed over-generous introduction, and I appreciate this award very much, especially in the light of its source and its tradition. However, one needs ways of preventing oneself from believing all these excessive things that are said about one, and my way of doing that is to draw bird cartoons. I don't have any artistic talent, but I can have these little stick figures of birds say things more directly than I can in my other writings. And I've even published a couple of little collections of them. And the particular bird cartoon that's relevant for this moment, which I'd like to consider my existential classic, goes this way. A small, young, enthusiastic bird looks up and says excitedly, "All of a sudden, I had this wonderful feeling, I am me." And an older, bigger, more jaundiced, more skeptical bird looks down at him and says, "You were wrong." On that note, I begin. I'm very grateful to the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation for this award and for their hospitality and sponsorship of the event, especially David Krieger and Chris Pazinet. And it means a great deal to me to be joining on this occasion with Richard Falk. You heard from him about the length and closeness of our friendship. Really, we've been peace colleagues and close friends for close to four decades. Richard and I were young men when we began our collaborations in books, organizations, protests, affirmations, and we seem to be still at it. The tennis has slowed down a little bit from certain sides, but everything else continues, and our present collaborations are equally vigorous. I think we are graying a bit, but we remain rebels with a cause. We meet tonight here as survivors, one may say historical survivors, not only of American wars, but of a recent presidential election. My argument this evening is that the way we survive, the meaning we give as Americans to the survivals that we are in the process of experiencing, has much to do with the American future, with the future we create. Richard mentioned Eric Erickson, the gifted psychoanalyst whom I worked closely with and was a kind of informal mentor for me for many years. He described how with young adult patients, they had to hit what he called rock bottom before they could show signs of health and recovery. We may be in the process of hitting rock bottom as a nation in the dangerous directions our leaders are taking us, and in a sense, rock bottom in ourselves as passionate opponents of these policies. Maybe like Erickson's patients, we have to first allow ourselves to experience that pain and foreboding and then emerge from that state in order to reassert our efforts at personal and national health. But to do that, we need to confront our historical and psychological actuality. We can't do it without that confrontation. Speaking personally, I sometimes feel that given the draconian subjects I've worked on, you know that when I'm in demand, the world is in trouble. Richard mentioned that metaphor, the abyss, which I continue to return to. We must always look into the abyss in order to see beyond it. And the present abyss is our war in Iraq and the policies that brought about that war. I'll return to it, but let me just say right now, as everybody in this audience knows or should know, this was neither a defensive nor even a preemptive war. It was a preventive war. And we must be particularly cognizant in the nuclear age of the dangers of preventive warfare. Some of you may be old enough to remember the talk of preventive war against the Soviet Union when it was learned that the Soviet Union was acquiring nuclear weapons and testing them. And there was many voices advocating a preventive war before they get more weapons and can endanger us. Had we listened to those voices, literally millions or tens of millions of people or more would have been killed. There's nothing more dangerous than preventive war in the nuclear age. I want to take you on a bit of a journey tonight that includes a brief look at past work I've done in terms of its bearing on present entrapments and dilemmas, some remarks on the worldwide epidemic of apocalyptic violence, or what I call superpower syndrome, and then a reexamination, and this is the theme of my talk, of the state of the psychology of the survivor in this country, not just Holocaust survivors or survivors of Hiroshima, but ourselves as Americans. And my idea is that by doing that, we can finally move toward directions of hope, modest ones, but with some importance. My method is psychological or psychohistorical, which means nothing more than applying psychological approaches to historical questions. And I've done this over the years, and without going into it in detail, let me just say it has a tradition in the work of Eric Erickson, who studied the great man or great person in history. My work has been to interview people involved in significant historical events, either as acted upon by them or as contributing to their being brought about or some combination of those, and studying the shared themes in those people, which represent much about them, but also about their time and era, about our present era in this case. That approach requires not just looking at the nitty-gritty of human behavior, but also at an ultimate level of larger human connectedness, the sense we have as the creatures who know that we die, of a need to, in some degree, live on, feel connected to, live on in and feel connected with forces that began prior to and will continue after what we know to be our limited lifespan, whether biological or biosocial, through families and communities, whether through some religious vision of an afterlife, or through so-called eternal nature, or through creative mode of our influences as teachers or writers or just as ordinary human beings. And one must keep in mind this ultimate level and the symbolization of life and death in these studies. And that takes one away from the classical emphasis or classical Freudian model of instinct and defense toward a model of the continuity of life, or death and the continuity of life. And it's from that kind of model that all of my work has evolved. In telling you something about the relevance of past work for our present entrapments, let me first say that there's something about the present situation that's different from my other studies, and it has to do with the fact that we are still in 9/11. It's not over. There's nothing that happens in this country that doesn't have some connection with 9/11 or some association. And of course, those associations are shamelessly manipulated by our administration. But when I studied other events like Hiroshima or Vietnam or Nazi doctors, they were grave and they had reverberations, but they ended. And I was studying them in retrospect. I'm now studying them, and you're considering them as participants in a process that continues. And that's enormously important. In terms of studies I've done that have bearing on what we're talking about, the first study I did was on Chinese thought reform in the mid-50s in Hong Kong, interviewing people coming out of China. I could say a great deal about it, but it really raised for me the problem of totalism, of all or none belief systems. And this has haunted all of my work subsequently. That totalism and that thought reform process really represented, I now recognize, what could be called an apocalyptic revolutionary impulse to destroy the existing mental world in order to recreate that mental or spiritual world in China with a complete new purity. And of course, I didn't take that to be something unique to the Chinese. This impulse toward what I call ownership of the mind can be expressed elsewhere, and I related it then to McCarthyism in the United States, and we can see parallels to it, not the exact process. We don't have systematic thought reform methods in this country at this time, but under the present Bush administration, we do have an attempt at controlling information and reality reversals, not just spin, but direct reversals of reality, which are built upon and acted upon. And in that sense, the thought reform process has enormous bearing on what we're in the middle of right now. But there's hope in this, despite its dark side, because the Chinese found that they over-reformed and in a way did much to turn the population against them by that over-control. And some of that process is going on in this country, too. Freud made a memorable statement in saying that the voice of the intellect is a soft one, but it shall not rest until it has had its hearing. We can say that the voice of reality is a soft one, but does not rest until it has had its hearing. I did a study subsequently of Hiroshima survivors in Hiroshima in 1962, and can say more about that, and we'll be discussing that tomorrow afternoon at the community college. But from that study, I learned a lot about survivors in general, and I began to think about the psychology of survivors, and I also began to think about the dimension of weaponry and how, just by its dimension, atomic and nuclear weaponry was apocalyptic in its essence. Because it's apocalyptic in its essence, we tend to bring religious symbols to the weaponry in justifying its use or in bringing about its use, or a kind of sacralization, often to the point of worshiping the weaponry. And certainly once I did that study, I saw and continue to see the world through the lens or prism of Hiroshima. I think all of the world now, since Hiroshima, has that lens, but it's more suppressed and covered. We know something about what a nuclear weapon can do, and that haunts us and affects every kind of conflict or interaction of this world. I did a study of Vietnam veterans in the 1970s, and among the many things that I learned was the phenomenon of what I came to call an atrocity-producing situation. By that, I meant and mean simply a situation in an environment that is so structured militarily and psychologically that ordinary people, no better or worse than you or me, can walk into it and commit atrocities. It's a socialization to atrocity, and it has to do with military policies. In the case of Vietnam, policies of free fire zones and body counts, along with the angry grief of soldiers who are losing buddies in a very dangerous situation, not being able to identify the enemy. The phrase, destroying a village to save it, you remember, came from Vietnam, and that's an apocalyptic statement writ small. And it was from that phrase that I gave the title to that subsequent book about Om Shinrikyo, Destroying the World to Save It. There also developed something interesting and highly constructive in relation to Vietnam, the phenomenon of opposing one's war while in the process of its being fought. And that had a tremendous impact on finally stopping, on the part of veterans, on finally stopping the Vietnam War. And that process we now see operating in a small but highly influential number of Israeli reserve officers and soldiers who refuse to fight in the occupied territories. And in talking to them, some of them, they've told me that they were much influenced by Vietnam veterans and by those of us who wrote about them, so that this process of opposing one's war or opposing war making when being called upon to carry out that war or after having experienced it can itself be contagious in a struggle for peace. I studied Nazi doctors during the late 70s and early 80s, and there was a reversal of healing and killing, a kind of apocalyptic biology in which there was a perverted idealism and the belief if you could only get rid of all bad genes, you'd get rid of not only mental illness, but all wrong behavior in the world. It had an absurdity, but elements of it were believed, and by and large, the majority of Nazi doctors whom I interviewed or learned about didn't have to be ideologues. They could be socialized to atrocity also. And there was a phenomenon I called doubling, the formation of what's functionally a second self, so that a Nazi doctor could be killing people from 9 to 5, 6 days a week in Poland and Auschwitz, and then go back to his family in Germany over weekends or leave time and be an ordinary husband and father. And that kind of doubling is not limited to Nazi doctors, but can occur in relation to killing processes, and I'm sure is not unknown in Iraq even as we speak. Also, the idea of killing to heal is not only a phenomenon of Nazi doctors, but an overall theme of all apocalyptic phenomena, that is, of all efforts to destroy on a large scale in order to spiritually purify. It also has been my own sad observation to find that American doctors haven't behaved like Nazi doctors, but they have colluded in torture in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. And I wrote a short piece recently in the New England Journal of Medicine describing their failure to report injuries that could only have been caused by torture, their turning over records and cooperating with interrogators, two interrogators and cooperating with them, and their falsifying and delaying death certificates. So again, medical misbehavior is by no means limited to the Nazis, and their very extremity in the Nazi case can help us to uncover less extreme, but nonetheless unacceptable violations such as these. My study of Om Shinrikyo in the late 1990s became all too relevant, as Richard said, in connection with 9/11. There's much that I can say about it, but I just want to indicate that here was this relatively small Japanese cult, less than 10,000 members and only 1,400 full-time so-called monks close to the guru, could not only kill about 100 people, but they had plans to initiate mass violence in Tokyo through the release of sarin gas when they couldn't get nuclear weapons, which they sought, in order to initiate World War III involving Japan and America and other countries, which would in turn bring about a biblical Armageddon. That's, of course, wild fantasy, but it was fantasy accompanied by the production of biological and chemical weapons, impure versions of them and incomplete, nonetheless, the production of some of that weaponry. So, and not only that, they had this vision of apocalyptic purification, and they did so with a phenomenon of long standing but little commented on. It's a phenomenon that has been called by the ancient rabbis forcing the end. There were great debates described by Gershon Scholem, the great recorder of Jewish mysticism, among ancient rabbis about whether, in order to enhance the coming of the Messiah, one has the right to or should enter into the violence, since it was known that violence had to precede his return. And the rabbis debated this and finally, happily decided that no, this was heretical to do it because only God could take such actions. Well, people like Asahara and Om Shinrikyo and other groups in this world are not so restrained and feel free toward entering into the process of bringing about Armageddon. That image and vision becoming more vivid by dint of the technology of destruction, nuclear weapons in particular, that they have available now. Throughout my work, I've also been concerned with alternatives. Speaking of the protean self, the many-sided contemporary self involving fluidity and flexibility and capacity for transformation and change. And I've been concerned with the struggles of that protean self to emerge and the conflicts between what can be called the protean self and the fundamentalist self with its impulse toward potentially apocalyptic violence. Now, if one looks at the larger question of apocalyptic violence, I'll say a word about it and then turn to the psychology of the survivor. Apocalyptic violence means violence that imagines the end of the world in some way or a large piece of the world in order to bring about total purification. And without going into it in detail, I would say it's much more widespread. I really see a kind of epidemic of it throughout the world than people realize, and one found it in ways that were hidden in connection with Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City and on both sides of terrorist violence in the Middle East among Israelis and Palestinians, and indeed, as I'll suggest now, in connection with American policies and American behavior. If in this light one asks, what does bin Laden want? What does al-Qaeda stand for? Certainly there's a political dimension, and the political dimension has been increasingly evident, in which they want to bring down America and get us out of the Middle East. But there's also the dimension of an apocalyptic and more amorphous aspect in which they seek to destroy all that is not sufficiently Islamist in the world in order to create a perfect and pure Islamic state and world. One can talk about that in terms of a terrorist dynamic because clearly there can be an apocalyptic project of this kind, yet there can also be real grievances. The apocalyptic project has to be opposed, the grievances have to be recognized, including a couple of centuries of imperialism and the carving out of the Middle East, and including various dynamics in which certain American policies interact with radical Islamist groups and intensify that kind of process. So one can then find, in connection with American recent behavior, and this is what I mean by the superpower syndrome, one can look at, for instance, a superpower's war on terrorism, and just to put that very briefly, the apocalyptic dimensions of our own war on terrorism, that is, responding to apocalyptic violence with apocalyptic tendencies of our own, those apocalyptic tendencies include a war on terrorism which has no limits geographically or in time and is an endless process and then a sense of continuous war. And from the very beginning, this was the kind of definition of the war on terrorism that was put forward. And a lot has to do with what I call superpower humiliation, the sense of a superpower being omnipotent, being punctured by 9/11, and this issue of humiliation being a back and forth one, like so much, in which it looms large in connection with al-Qaeda and Islamist experience, and it looms large with American experience in a back and forth process, or what I called at one point a duty dance with death, that the two sides enter into. Then one can look at apocalyptic tendencies in our own country, a kind of military fundamentalism combined with Christian apocalypticism and its influence in the administration. And without going into that in detail, I would emphasize that the sense that our leadership and the president himself have of carrying out a grand design, or what Woodward described as God's master plan, that is our own apocalyptic sense, and one finds a lot of indication that there is an equal impulse to destroy much of the world that we find unsatisfactory in order to reconstitute it in our own image. And then we get the polarization of the world and the axis of evil and that kind of language and approach. There's an issue of superpower vulnerability because the strongest military power in the world is probably the most fearful. It is because in this kind of apocalyptic projection, we seek absolute security, which is impossible. That would go along with superpower omnipotence. And any threat to that absolute security renders us fearful. Moreover, we're on a project or a mission or even a crusade to carry through our policies and control much of the world, which is built on a certain degree of fantasy and impossible to achieve, and therefore a constant frustration and enormous fear. And the nuclear issue enters very greatly into our fear, because the policies that we have, and especially those in relation to nuclear weapons, a kind of almost pure nuclearism, those policies stimulate nuclearism in other countries, which in turn we feel threatened by. Nuclear proliferation remains an overwhelming problem for the world, but nuclear proliferation cannot be dealt with simply by military threats. And in fact, methods taken to curb nuclear proliferation can have the opposite effect. All this is part of what I call an attempt at fluid world control. Our empire is an empire, but it's different from prior empires. We don't systematically put bureaucrats on the ground and seek to carry through certain institutional reforms and controlling them over time as the British Empire did, but rather we move in and out in efforts to control the events of history. It's an effort at controlling history, and the bases that we create, for instance, in Iraq and elsewhere in the world, are an expression of fluid world control, as is the National Security Strategy document of September 2002, which talks about the control of different regions of the world and the certainty we must have that no nation can imagine itself threatening us in terms of military superiority. So superpower on this kind of mission has to be haunted by a fear of weakness, because this kind of fluid world control can never really be achieved. Well, it's useful to turn to issues involving the psychology of survivors, and specifically involving ourselves, Americans, as survivors, in order to look toward the future with hope and with possibilities for extricating ourselves from the kind of situation I'm describing. One can say that there have been two great violent events since the middle of the 20th century affecting America, and those of Vietnam and 9/11. Now we have a third, that of Iraq and the Iraq War. The big question is how we survive those events and the degree to which the war in Iraq is going to be known as the centerpiece of the George W. Bush era, how we survive that in turn. One can say that there's an intermingling of survivor emotions, that is, ordinary survivals that we all have in our lives of people close to us who die or other forms of survival intermingle with our feelings about surviving Vietnam, 9/11, Iraq, and the survivals of each of these events intermingle. That's the way the psyche works, and that's one reason why the Bush administration is able to carry through certain falsehoods, like the assumption that Iraq was in some way involved in 9/11, because our survivor emotions can tend to blend. But it's our task to distinguish these, as we must, and as I'm trying to do tonight. Now, these survivor emotions are important in the effects they have on our psyches, because if one undergoes a direct survival, there's a threat to one's whole psychic structure, a feeling of loss in which mental forms that one had in one's mind can tend to break down. Survivor psychology, in that sense, always retains a death imprint, but what I want to emphasize in terms of survivor psychology is the desperate requirement of survivors to find meaning in what they have survived, and therefore some kind of mission from that survival. Meaning and mission, it's a kind of debt to the dead, as it's sometimes called. It's the dead who have authority, and survivors who try to in some way respond to that authority of the dead. There's always the feeling on the part of survivors that they must not let the dead to have died in vain. Now, there are levels of survivors, of course. It's very different if you survived the Vietnam War as somebody who fought there, or 9/11 as somebody who was in the Twin Towers, or similarly, Iraq as somebody who fought there, as opposed, those are direct survivors, as opposed to the rest of us who are survivors from a distance, more distant survivors. Nonetheless, we feel these events, and actually, there's an interaction between direct survivors and distant survivors. Direct survivors experience things viscerally, more distant survivors tend to experience them ideologically or intellectually, but nonetheless have that experience and often are the ones who lay out the meaning structures as leaders. It's the distant survivors who often lay out the meaning structures that society embraces. One has to realize that these events don't give any meaning in themselves. It's survivors and others who bring meaning structures to them. What the events do is give an enormous intensity, a life-death intensity, to any reaction to them. But the meaning structures are created by others. And the interaction between immediate survivors and distant survivors is always evident. For instance, during the last few years in Vietnam, troops fighting there were playing anti-war songs on their phonographs in Vietnam, and the most popular of which was Country Joe and the Fishers, I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag, which is the most powerful anti-war song of that era. So that's the interaction between the peace movement in this country and the soldiers fighting in Vietnam who were beginning to turn against their war, between the distant survivors and the immediate survivors of the war. And that kind of interaction is now going on with the Iraq War as well. If one looks at, just to put it briefly, the three survivals that I've been mentioning, Vietnam, 9/11, and Iraq, one finds that the meanings that we have given them in our society tend to be polarized. Opposite meanings given to the same events. And that's what we have to recognize, and that's where we have to articulate our own stand. If you look at Vietnam, for instance, there was a crucial survivor meaning and mission that took shape over the course of the Vietnam War and after, and that was mainstream opposition with the American defeat to the kind of war with dubious purposes in a faraway place against the non-white population that Vietnam represented. And the meaning given and the survivor mission given was restraint to avoid such wars. But perhaps it was not clear to many of us that there was a survivor mission at the opposite pole of policy, feeling that any such restraint was part of what they called a Vietnam syndrome, meaning a syndrome of American weakness. If you remember, the most ringing words of George Bush Sr. at the end of the first Gulf War were, "By God, we have kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all." And if you look at the group of self-described Vulcans written about in a very good book by James Mann called The Rise of the Vulcans, and these are Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Armitage, and Condoleezza Rice, they all embraced a survivor mission of belligerence in relation to the Vietnam War. Mann says that the impact of the Vietnam debacle was similar for all the Vulcans, whether they fought in the war or not. Most didn't. The defeat in Vietnam led to a preoccupation with first regaining and then maintaining American military power. In other words, the survivor mission for them, for Vietnam, was to reassert all the more powerfully American military might in the world as a response to Vietnam. It's something like fighting the war over again and winning it, but it's new wars. And in that sense, both Gulf Wars can be seen as fought in connection with survivor missions for Vietnam. If you look at 9/11, there also are different survivor missions. The war on terrorism, which I mentioned briefly, was the survivor mission of the administration in connection with Vietnam, and it was apocalyptic and all-enveloping and still is in many ways. And when that happens, you get this tandem relationship between the apocalyptic perpetrators of 9/11 and the responders. But at the same time, there was also an alternative survivor mission, which many of us tried to explore, and that was to look underneath the terrorism, certainly to seek out the terrorists and bring them to justice, and that would require use of force, but minimal use of force, along with looking to the sources of apocalyptic violence and looking historically at these issues and seeking to find ways to diminish or prevent it from occurring. That was the alternative point of view, and many Americans were really caught between these two points of views, but were led specifically more directly to the aggressive version, the war on terrorism. And it has left a reservoir of potential belligerence which the administration has drawn upon. Nonetheless, we still hear very important actions from family members of those lost in 9/11, and their survivor mission is again of an alternative kind, to look carefully at the causes of 9/11. It was through their efforts that the commission investigating 9/11 came into being and had its work extended. People can find fault with the commission, but at least it was an attempt enormously influenced by family members and their survivor mission of 9/11. Then Iraq. If one looks at Iraq, as I've indicated, and we know it was planned at least a decade ago, and in a way the 9/11 was a release for the war on Iraq, nonetheless, it became a survivor mission of 9/11. And in that sense, Iraq was a survivor mission of Vietnam in the way that I just mentioned, the Vulcans' embrace of an aggressive policy to reverse Vietnam, but it was also a survivor mission of 9/11. And it was, again, of the highest belligerence. And once initiated, the Iraq War created survivor missions of its own. That is, people fighting there, and the rest of us, have feelings and images do come through of what's going on there, despite some success in the elections, but very flawed success, and the sense of chaos and extensive killing is still very, very evident. But there's a conflict now, because the traditional survivor mission in wartime is to emphasize that soldiers must not be allowed to have died in vain, and therefore one must take up their work and continue that work to its completion and pursue the war ever more vigorously. That's the attitude of the administration in connection with the Iraq War. The alternative survivor mission questions the meaning and significance of the war and whether it justifies any of these deaths. And the only way in that alternative survivor mission that these deaths cannot have been in vain is if we can learn from those deaths the futility of such war making. And I think that Americans are caught between these two versions of Iraq. Unfortunately, John Kerry had a great opportunity to bring the powerful alternative survivor mission he expressed in connection with Vietnam. How can we ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam, to die for a mistake, as he put it so eloquently before a congressional committee? But he didn't bring that same clarity as a survivor mission to the war in Iraq. He hemmed and hawed, and if he had brought that clarity, we would have come to recognize, a larger number of people would have come to recognize the truth of that war, which itself is a series of atrocity-producing situations. And certainly, if you look at events in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, you have a parallel atrocity-producing situation to the kind that I described in Vietnam. In this case, it's also a counterinsurgency war, an alien and hostile ground against a non-white enemy who is everywhere and nowhere and can't be pinned down. And it's highly dangerous, with men being killed, and you get angry grief, and you get developments like Abu Ghraib, along with a kind of fantasy that if we can just do enough interrogation and break down enough people and get them to confess, we'll somehow draw out truths that will justify what is an unjustifiable war. There are, again, encouraging developments, though, in which there's a constant comparison now, not just by types like me, but by mainstream journalists, in equating Iraq with Vietnam, or comparing them with the quagmire idea that we're stuck in something that's life-threatening that we can't extricate ourselves from, and that some of these truths that I just described are coming through, and this leaves Americans caught between these survivor missions and struggling with them. And now there's a very important new development. It's gotten little attention. It could become much more important. The emergence of anti-war Iraq veterans, some of them now in collaboration with anti-war Vietnam veterans, and there is a new organization Iraq Veterans Against the War, modeled on the similar Vietnam organization. And this is, again, an expression of the alternative survivor mission that I've been describing. And of course, this has a noble tradition. World War I created a vast literature out of an alternative survivor mission about the war being wrong and unjust, and you had that develop in connection with Vietnam. And really, even if you read Homer's Iliad, you find that along with the glorification of heroism is an undercurrent of sadness and loss and meaninglessness of the Trojan War, and that's been true of just about any war fought subsequently. Well, there is what we can call, and we must constantly keep this in mind, the possibility for survivor illumination. Gary Wills has written a wonderful book called Lincoln at Gettysburg, describing a kind of survivor illumination that Lincoln extricated from that dreadful battlefield and calling for the meaning of that survival being a new birth of freedom. And you had wonderful post-World War II literature, Albert Camus, Kurt Vonnegut, and Günter Grass, all of whom I've been interested in terms of the illumination they derive from being direct survivors of some of the horrors of World War II. And that's why Heinrich Bull, a talented post-war German novelist, could say, "The artist carries death within him like a good priest his breviary." The artist can create from that death encounter as a survivor and bring a certain wisdom to that process. And that's our hope and our possibility. Because the truth is, and these are to be my concluding remarks, we can do better in the world. We're capable of wiser, more measured approaches, more humane applications of our considerable power in the world. We will remain a strong power in the world. We don't have to delude ourselves with being an omnipotent superpower. This would be reclaiming our moral compass, and it would also be liberating ourselves from the extraordinary pressures to which we're subjecting ourselves to carry through this illusory project. Really, you know, it's been said that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, the famous phrase from Lord Acton, but the truth is that what corrupts is the quest for absolute power. The vision or fantasy of absolute power is totally corrupting. It places one on a treadmill, and we've really become Sisyphus with bombs, trying to climb up the hill of Hades, never quite getting to the top. And this happens at a time when there's a decline in the nation state, and we seek to fill the vacuum with American control, but which is not recognized as legitimate, but rather the opposite. In all this, everything we do counts in opposing it, because even the most modest action enters into the collective consciousness. There is an issue here about 9/11 and our survival of it, and it has to do with victim consciousness. On one of my trips back to Hiroshima, I was very moved to hear from survivor leaders their reflection on what they called victim consciousness or exaggerated victim consciousness in Hiroshima survivors. And they said that this could be a real danger because people could become obsessed and lose their balance. And one way they tried to overcome it was to meet with other survivors, including Holocaust survivors, in order to share various forms of suffering. We have to, in some way, overcome our exaggerated victim consciousness in connection with 9/11. It was a dreadful event. It was a crime against humanity. But it has to be seen in terms of its significance and in terms of ways of preventing not only recurrence of that event, but various forms of violence that we ourselves are enmeshed in. It's interesting that certainly the Islamist extremists or Al-Qaeda groups see themselves as victimized and humiliated. And again, we have this dance back and forth in relation to victimization. It also means surrendering the claim of certainty or ownership of truth. Nobody owns truth. David Tracy, the wonderful Jesuit philosopher, has written a book called Plurality and Ambiguity, in which he describes how great visionaries of faith always had elements of ambiguity and elements of doubt in putting forward their faith. There may be more tolerance for ambiguity than we realize, and I try to write about this again in connection with the Protean self. And to recognize ambiguity means also to recognize vulnerability. Vulnerability is an aspect of the human condition. We can't rid ourselves of it, and it has to do with accepting the fact that we die. And it means really rejecting various immortality projects on the part of people that require destruction of others in order to be asserted. So that really requires that we take some advice of the great French writer Albert Camus in what he called the philosophy of limits. He said, to live and die as human beings, we need to refuse to be a god and embrace thought which recognizes limits. He also said, he who does not know everything cannot kill everyone. And there's a lot of wisdom to that. That's also survivor wisdom. Let me close by saying that, in terms of all that I've been saying, the survivor can either close down or open out. The survivor can close down and numb himself or herself and be preoccupied with fantasies of revenge, or the survivor can open out to the pain he and she are undergoing and the pain of others and learn more about life and death. The same can be said about our own experience as survivors now. We can close down our collective imagination and stay fixed in our polarization of good and evil, as we're doing so much now, or we can open out our psyches and our collective imagination to probe the sources of this pain that I'm describing, the sources of our own crises, and take steps toward diminishing rather than increasing violence in the world. Let me close with two quotations, because it's the artists and writers who can best say these things. And the first is from Seneca more than 2,000 years ago. Power over life and death, don't be proud of it. Whatever they fear from you, you'll be threatened with. And the second is that line from Theodore Rutger that Richard mentioned, which has to be put forward again and again. In a dark time, the eye begins to see. Thank you very much. You've heard me sound off. Now I'd like to hear from you. So we welcome questions or very brief comments, and David will supervise.
So we do have time for some questions. Yes.
Yeah, could you comment from a psychological perspective on why so many thousands of people rally around leaders when disaster strikes? No matter how brutal or lazy or inept those leaders might be?
It's a very large and very important question. It doesn't have an easy answer. I think at the heart of it is, though, the fear of annihilation by ordinary people in crisis and the promise of protection offered by leaders, often protection, as we saw in our case, through belligerent policies, which can carry forward a sense of strength or an illusion of strength. But it's the fear of death or annihilation and the promise of protection that's at the heart, I think, of the process that you raise.
Professor Lifton, I wanted to ask you just very quickly, do you think, and I'll make a little explanation afterwards, but do you think constitutional government is irrelevant in an age of alternatives or alternating between survivor mentality and alternative survivor mentality? And I ask you that because that book you referenced by Mann about the Vulcans was terribly frightening to me because it revealed dimensions of the executive branch I didn't know existed and that apparently have existed since the National Security Act of 1947 and have increased in scope, range, and power. And it's completely invisible to the American people. And it's justified by this survival mentality that you mentioned, which goes obviously back to World War II, the Holocaust, Hiroshima, and so forth. So my question is, are we just deluding ourselves in this kind of modern age we're in to think that our Constitution can survive? Or do you think it has legs?
I believe that it and we can survive, but not easily. And everything depends on what we do. If you're not a complete historical determinist, then you see history as an open process. it can be influenced. And the survivor psychology that I describe becomes important because we're victims of so many disasters. And that's survivor psychology looms large, even though people can numb themselves and take distance from it. And the Constitution, as much as it's trampled upon in recent days, still has sources of opposition to suppressive behavior that was manifest during McCarthyism. It's more difficult now because the government in charge is perpetrating these violations. Nonetheless, there are still traditions in this country, call them Jeffersonian, connect them to the Constitution and to our history. There are traditions that we can call upon to oppose these directions, and they come from our way of surviving these events.
Yes.
I wanted to thank you, Professor, for bringing psychology into a topic, politics, war, violence, that doesn't usually get treatment in the public sphere. We're very quick to dismiss psychology as a mode of analysis, at least in major media outlets, etc. I wanted to ask you again a little bit more about the psychology of apocalyptic thinking and what seems to be myopia that goes along with it. And by that, I'm referring to a myopia that allows, for instance, the U.S. government to accuse Iran of carrying out actions for nuclear proliferation at the same time we are developing nuclear weapons against the NPT treaty. And myopia that allows the U.S. government to accuse Iran and Syria of interfering with the elections in Iraq, all the while we are effectively directing these elections and carrying out endless numbers of interferences. So my question is, what do you see going on at the level of individual psychology that directs people to follow these sort of myopic and apocalyptic ways of thought? Coming out of survivor mentality, you can go belligerent or towards illumination. What do you see at the level of the individual that maybe directs a person or a community to go one way or the other?
The first thing to say, it's an important question also, the first thing to say is that it's not just an individual psychological process. It's collective, and it's a tendency in the society. People of my generation would never have dreamt that there'd be this degree of apocalypticism in our society, or even a fundamentalism, which is a step prior to apocalypticism but can lead to it. So that it has to do with movements of people who are alienated and who are angry and who feel various fear of a prior existence somehow leaving them or being threatened. I think, for instance, in the last election, there was a combination of fear, including continuing fear of terrorism, as manipulated by a drumbeat from the administration on the one hand, and fear on a larger historical basis of the loss of some kind of small town perfection that never existed, but a kind of nostalgia for and fear over a kind of existence that was being taken away. In individual psychological terms, though, it has to do with identity and self, and it's tricky because you can find people taking fundamentalist directions growing up in families that were quite liberal and open, and sometimes the children yearning for some kind of absolute or some kind of full clarity. So there's no psychological guarantee about how one can prevent that from happening. I think candor in one's family relationships, even candor about one's own confusions as parents, helps a great deal in preventing this kind of reaction. I think the larger question has to do with these social currents that I mentioned.
Thank you very much for your provocative lecture. You touched on the powers of artists and writers to awaken us on these issues. And I wonder if you have any suggestions on how to engage writers and artists to awaken us from the nuclear trance, or even those creative powers that reside in all of us that are expressed most beautifully in artists and writers to address that issue.
In terms of writers emerging with survivor illumination, in a way, it's sort of a paradox. You'd like to encourage it, but it has to occur spontaneously from their own experience. Nobody could have told Vonnegut or Grass or Camus that they should write in a form of survivor illumination. However, your question does take on importance in terms of, I know that you're thinking about in terms of teaching and learning and exercises in which young people and not so young people can be encouraged to look at various death encounters with the protection of a group and of some kind of supervision, in which they can recognize that it's okay to really take in some of these things and one can learn from them. That can be a group process, it can be a kind of exercise, because the tendency is widespread toward numbing, toward the opposite pattern of blocking out any of these patterns, because to take them in is to bring about some kind of change and movement. And it becomes a political as well as a psychological process, and also pedagogical. They're all inseparable. It can be political in the noblest sense of opening up minds toward various forms of experience, which is perhaps the larger meaning of politics. But in my approach, I work as somebody psychologically trained, but it would be wrong to see psychology as the answer. I'm bringing a psychological perspective to ethical and political problems. They all intermingle in the way that you're suggesting.
Thank you.
Last question.
Dr. Lifton, thank you very much. I was particularly intrigued in your comment about exaggerated victimhood and how the victims of Hiroshima would get together with victims of the Holocaust in order to share the suffering. And one of the things that confused me about 9/11 was our utter failure to see that other nations had also endured terrorist attacks. Italy, England, Germany, the list was endless. Is there something in the way we tell our national story or build our national identity that makes it difficult for us to identify with the suffering of others and to bring our victim identification into context?
I think the tendency to identify with the suffering of one's own kind is universal. It's not just us. But it could be that there are particular elements in American experience, because America has, throughout its history, had a certain separateness from the world, the sense of being invulnerable because of the two oceans and the sense of being specially blessed by history. We didn't consider ourselves to be vulnerable to the pain of the world, and it's shocking to Americans to find fellow Americans in pain. But I don't think that's exclusively American by any means. It has to do with distancing the suffering of others, which has always been a human tendency. The answer to it, or the way of, or a direction of overcoming it, has to do with bringing the suffering of others closer to one. When the Hibakusha, or Japanese survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, go around the world telling their stories, they're trying to, in the first case, embrace a survivor mission of finding meaning in their pain by telling the world what nuclear weapons can do. But they're also doing what you are raising, bringing suffering far away, closer to us. There are other ways of doing this, and sometimes, with all of its deficiencies, and they are many, television can help with this, because we can experience the suffering of others. But with television alone, it becomes virtual, and we enter in and move away from it quickly, unless it's followed up with some kind of understanding, some sort of further interpretation, and some possibility for doing something that's helped along by thoughtful people and leaders.
If I may make just a final comment, Dr. Lifton made reference to, I think, an extraordinary concept of Sisyphus with the bomb. And, of course, Camus, who you also talk about as somebody who opened doors and had a vision of something better out of his survivor experience. Camus, after studying Sisyphus rolling the rock up the hill and pushing it up the hill, and it rolled down and pushing it up and it rolled down, at the end of Camus' famous essay, he imagined Sisyphus to be happy in his task. And it seems to me that, in part, happiness or fulfillment in the kind of world in which we live and in which you describe that we have choices as survivors is for each of us to take some stand at disarming Sisyphus. We need to take those bombs away from Sisyphus and let him return to his ordinary tasks of rolling the rock up the hill. That's one of the things I took from your comments. I hope that some of you will join in that task of seeking to disarm Sisyphus from the bombs that he now carries. You can find out more about what we do at the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and particularly I address this to students out in the audience, at our website, www.wagingpeace.org. You can find out about a history of the nuclear age at our website, www.nuclearfiles.org. And I really encourage you to look into these and become involved. I would like to just express our very, very deep appreciation to Dr. Lifton for coming out to be with us tonight and for an extraordinarily thoughtful and provocative lecture. Thank you.
You have been listening to Robert J. Lifton speaking at the University of California at Santa Barbara on February 16th of 2005. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.